Ed started his teaching career in New York City in 1962. He received a doctorate in education from the University of Kansas in 1970 and spent 13 years at Ball State University in Indiana as a professor and chairman of elementary education. He came to Georgia College in 1983 as dean of the College of Education and held that position for 13 years, at which time he returned to teaching graduate courses until his retirement in 2000. I don't think he retired. In 1997, he received a Bachelor of Arts degree in French from Georgia College and presents himself as an alumnus of the college, a professor emeritus as well as dean emeritus. His most significant professional achievement is the development of the highly regarded undergraduate and graduate teaching preparations program at Georgia College. Ed is now semi-retired and lives in Blue Ridge, where he provides personal financial advising for a variety of clients and writing extensively on that topic. And he is the treasurer of our church. Ed.
Thank you. I don't need that. Well, we have the first slide, please. Now, truth in advertising. I made a list a bunch of years ago about things that really pissed me off. And I told Carl, I said, you know, you ever have a time when a speaker couldn't come? You know, I'd make a presentation on this. He said, okay, and now I'm doing it. But the thing is that Carl advertises this in the papers, and I didn't want to put piss me off in the papers. Piss is one of these words like crap. It's borderline. I mean, is it obscene or is it not obscene? I didn't want to take any chances in print. But the fact of the matter is that the things that I'm going to talk about today are things that piss me off. And so I want to know that, and if you're offended, too bad. Okay, I want to start with some things that that are minor things that just irk me. Like you're driving along a two-lane in the same direction, okay, and the guy in front of you is going slowly, and so you want to pass, and there's somebody in the left lane, and he or she stays there. And never got the idea that you should drive right and pass left. They were absent that day when they taught that at driver's school. That irks me, because I think it induces road rage, you know? And you have probably had the experience where you're just angry at that. Another thing that irks me, TV remotes. Why can't they standardize these? So you turn it on with this button, you turn it off with that button. Why do I have to go through a learning experience every time I go to a motel or I'm out of town for something, you know? It irks me. And then there are celebrities in politics, you know? People who are celebrities think that they are so full of themselves that their political views would be the views of everybody else. A good example is Barbra Streisand, who is one of the most talented singers I've ever heard. She's marvelous. She can do stuff with a song. Just wonderful. But when she starts talking about politics and economics, she's a ninny. And, you know, I mean, she has absolutely no idea what she's talking about. So those are the things that irk me, okay? And they're small, and maybe they irk you too. Let's go to the next slide, please. Now we're getting into some serious stuff. The federal government. I'm going to try to be nonpartisan here because I am basically nonpartisan. And I'm a libertarian. Some of you know that about me. But the problems that we have in government are not centered on any one particular party. Democrats do it. Republicans do it. Everybody does it. And it really pisses me off. First thing, taxes. Tax the rich. I've been hearing this for 20, 30 years. Tax is rich, okay. All right, who are the rich? Well, the rich are people who make more than $100,000 or $200,000 per household, or over $250,000, whatever. Those aren't necessarily the rich. Those are the people who are well compensated. Are they rich? Well, if they've been tucking some money away and investing it and having it multiply, they might be rich. But I've had clients who are well compensated, never put anything away. They're not rich. And I have other clients who have lived modestly, and they don't have or never had much of an income, but they put money away, and they have wealth. Okay, wealth is good. As a matter of fact, money is good. And I might just share with you an insight I had a couple of weeks ago. I thought to myself, money is not important unless you don't have any. Think about that. All right, so tax the rich, you know. Yes, well, who's rich? And they define being rich as having income. And that's wrong. It's just a misuse of words. And the looseness of language coming from our government is terrible. Now, Elizabeth Warren, with whom I don't agree on everything, but at least she's honest about it. She's saying tax the wealthy. These are the people who have some money put away. Okay, fine. I don't think she's gonna be able to do it. I mean, it took a congressional, it took an act of Congress, an amendment to the Constitution to authorize income tax. And that was over 100 years ago. There's nothing in the Constitution that says anything about taxation of wealth. So I don't know how she would do it, or even whether it can be done, but at least she's being honest about it. She's talking about taxing wealth and not equating wealth with income. It's interesting, last week, how many of you were here last week? Would you raise your hands again? Okay, well, our Muslim brother said something that, I don't know if you picked up on it, but I picked up on it. Every religion says that you should give to charity, give to the poor in the Muslim tradition. In Islam, they say to give alms. Okay, great. But when they talked about, from a Muslim point of view, giving is not a percentage of your income. He said they are expected to give 2.5% of their wealth. That's a difference. Because the real money in this country is not the people who are earning a lot of money necessarily, it's the people who've had generations in this country and have built up immense fortunes, and she wants to tap that. Well, you know, good luck to her. I don't think it can be done, but at least she's being honest about it. Another thing, and that is spending. Okay, politicians will say, we cut the budget. And you say, well, what did you cut? And they say, well, we cut, you know, whatever it is, whatever line item, we've cut the budget. It turns out that they're spending more money on that item. So how'd they cut the budget? Well, see, they didn't quite cut the budget. They cut the increase that they were going to assign to that. In other words, if you had an item for $100 million and you were going to, and this is the way most budget management goes. You go from what you've already done to what you want to have done. So you have something that's $100 million, small item, okay? And you were going to increase that by 2%. And what would that be? 2% of 100 million would be 2 million, right? Well, they decided not to do that. We're gonna cut the budget. We're only gonna raise this line item 1%, and so it'll be $101 million. Okay. At my age, I shouldn't do this without notes. Get very confused. Anyway, so they equate cutting the budget, which, in the parlance of most people, means like you're going to spend less money. But that's not what they mean. They're cutting the amount of growth. And that's, it's dishonest. It's just not right, okay? then there's the idea of responsibility, okay? And this one really, really bothers me. You may have seen the movie Fahrenheit 9/11, Michael Moore. And in that movie, the thing about Michael Moore is you never know when he's acting as a journalist or whether he's acting as a comedian. And so I have difficulty with understanding exactly what he's getting at. But in Fahrenheit 9/11, Michael Moore was interviewing John Conyers, the late congressman from Michigan. And Michael Moore made the comment, he said, boy, you must have a lot of reading all these bills that come through your office. And he looks at him and says, Michael, we don't read all those bills. And I thought to myself, what do you mean you don't read all those bills, you know? But apparently they don't. Maybe their staff reads them. But anyway, you know. So flash forward a dozen or so years. Nancy Pelosi, when she is pushing Obamacare, okay, and she made the comment, you may remember it, we've got to pass the bill in order to read it. That's what she said. We've got to pass the bill in order to read it. And I thought to myself, as a citizen, wouldn't it make more sense, this is our congressional, well, this is somebody's congressional representative, wouldn't it make more sense to read the bill first before you vote on it? Because then you'd know what you're voting for. But what she's saying is we have to pass the bill in order to read it. So we'll pass it, then we'll read it. this is asked backwards. And it doesn't make any sense. So I did a little research. Turns out Congress has been doing this for years and years and years. The Volstead Act in 1919, of which introduced prohibition to this country, went through Congress, signed into law, became an amendment. That was the law of the land. It mentioned that they were dealing with the act deals with the manufacturing, distribution, and sale of intoxicating liquors. Okay? Doesn't say anything about drinking. Drinking this stuff is not prohibited. It's just the manufacture, distribution, and sale. Well, it turns out that intoxicating liquors includes beer and wine. Anybody ever get drunk on beer? Anybody ever got drunk on wine? I have. It's intoxicating. An intoxicating liquor is anything that is more than 0.5% alcohol. And that's just about everything. Even the weakest beers, which don't even deserve to be called beer, have about 2 or 3% of alcohol. You know, most beers have about 6 to 10%. Most whiskeys are about 35%, 40%, 45%. But they passed the Volstead Act, not having read it, or if they had read it, not understanding it, and as a result, you know. You had the Roaring Twenties, which gave organized crime a big boost because people wanted to drink. It was ill-conceived, it was finally repealed, but there's an example of what happens when you don't read before you vote. It was bad, okay? All right. Misuse and abuse of language. You know, I consider myself having been put here on earth to reduce ambiguity, you know, and use language correctly. I was in a Publix when I was living in Decatur, and it was near Emory University. And I shopped there quite a bit, and then I saw a sign at one of the checkout booths. It says Express Lane, okay? 10 items or less. And I thought to myself, that's not right. So I asked to see the manager. I asked the assistant manager, and then he called over the manager. And I said, you know, you've got a sign here that says express lane, 10 items or less. That's not good use of the English language. It should be 10 items or fewer. He looked at me funny, said, are you an English teacher? I said, no, but I'm careful about language, and I do a lot of writing. I said, now, you know, I know it may not be a big thing to you, but, you know, we're right near Emory University. And here is here is a sign that is misusing the English language, you know, not today, but next time you remodel the store, which happens every few years, why don't you put that sign saying, express lane, 10 items or fewer? He said, yeah, okay. I said, well, you know, they're probably going away saying, who is this kook? I mean, does he come here often? 3 years later, the sign was changed. And so, if you see something wrong, say something. Since we've had a lot of terrorism threats, and the people in charge of security of this country have said, see something, say something. And that certainly goes with regard to situations which involve terrorism. However, from the point of view of your own values, you know, if you see something, say something. Racial or ethnic defamation? Beg pardon? Well, that's a brand name. They're allowed that, you know. Oh, I'm sorry. That's their name. Publix is the name of the store. That's not Publix. Isn't it Publix? Okay, this is called a mistake. And it's no big deal. Okay, we all know it's Publix. Thank you for pointing that out. Very nice. Anyway, racial or ethnic defamation. I don't like this at all. Not because I'm Jewish, but because I'm a person, and I don't like to see other people defamed. The N-word. I was about 6 years old, and I was out playing with my friends, and I came home, and I was talking to my dad, and I used the N-word. And he stopped. He said, don't use that word. I said, why not? He said, Negroes find it offensive, and it's not nice. Well, I said, okay, well, what shall I call it? He says, call the Negroes. That was the politically correct term of the time. I said, okay. So next day I'm out playing with my friends, and African-Americans came up in the conversation, and I referred to them as Negroes. Well, they thought I was putting on airs. You know, they wouldn't even talk to me for a little bit. Oh, who's he, you know? So what my dad, you know, hears something offensive, say something. And he did. And I don't use that word. I have trouble using it even in a presentation, even with quotation marks. It's because it is offensive. Now, you can have a black person refer to another black person as a nigger. That's okay. That's between them, okay? But if a white person says it to a black person, it's a whole different story. And it's the same way with jokes. Brother Seidman here could call me a kike or a heeb or something, or a member of the tribe or some other epithet for being Jewish. Wouldn't bother me because he's Jewish, you know? So no big deal. But if somebody else were to call me that, well, that's something else. Ethnic jokes. Some of the funniest jokes I've ever heard are ethnic jokes. And whether I laugh at them depends on who's saying it. If there's a black person who's making a joke about black people and I laugh, I'm laughing with him. But if it's a white person that's telling the same joke, then I'm laughing at the black person. And there's a big difference in my view of that, because it's just not right. We shouldn't treat each other like that. And so what I say is, hear something offensive, say something. At minimum, if somebody were to refer to somebody by a racial slur, at minimum, walk away. Okay? What you could do is say, I find that word offensive. Not, you know, you're an idiot, you know, you're a fool because you know, but an I message. I find that offensive. And they'll say, well, big deal. I say, okay. But I just would register a complaint. Because that's the only way we're ever going to ever get rid of that stuff. Okay. Misinformation in print. Now, this really, really bothers me. Okay? Read something not accurate, respond. Okay. About 20 years ago, many of you know I had a career in education, and then in the mid-90s, I decided to have another career in financial planning, and so I prepared myself for that with a program, and I took a bunch of economics courses and accounting courses at Georgia College and got to know this stuff, okay? One course I took called Money and Banking, okay? And here's the book that was assigned to us. It's called The Economics of Money, Banking, and Financial Markets. Sounds good, okay? Sixth edition, it's been around for a while, okay? And the author is Frederick S. Mishkin. Who's he? Well, Dr. Mishkin is a professor at Columbia University. He is also a former governor of the Federal Reserve Board. I mean, this guy is in high places. And so there's that, you know, his renown and the fact that it's a sixth edition and it was selected by the instructor for our textbook. This is okay. Well, I'm reading along and admittedly, at the time I was taking this course, I knew more than the average person about finance and all. And so I'm reading the book and I said, wait, this is not right. Made a little notation. Reading along later on, no, that's wrong. And then later on, there's something else that bothered me. So I went to the instructor. I said, you know, I found these things in the textbook we're using, and it's kind of bothersome. And he looked at it. And he said, yeah, you're right. I said, well, somebody ought to tell the author. I said, will you tell him or should I tell him? He says, well, I'll tell him. So what he did was he contacted the publisher. He says, I'll contact the publisher. So he contacted, publisher? Addison Wesley Longman, reputable house, okay. And then I'm visiting several years later, and I said, hey, you remember that those errata I found in that textbook? And you brought it to the attention of the publisher. I said, did you ever hear back from them? He said, no, never did. I said, well, I can't let that stand. I said, so I'm gonna contact the author. Okay, now we're talking about a renowned person here, you know. So I sent him an email. What? I haven't even read it yet. To Frederick Mishkin. Subject, errata in your textbook. I figured that would get his attention, you know. Who wants to hear that? Professor Mishkin, a dozen or so years ago, I took a course in money and banking in which we were assigned your textbook, The Economics of Money, Banking, and Financial Markets, 6th edition. The textbook read well and was a good learning experience. However, I noted 3 errata in the text and brought this to the attention of my course instructor, who agreed with me and who, upon my request, sent the information to your publisher. Last week, I was chatting with the instructor and asked him about the status of this matter, and he mentioned that he had never heard back from the publisher and checked the 8th edition, that's the one they were using then, and the errata was still there. I call this to your attention, I'm talking to Professor Mishkin now. I call this to your attention for two reasons. One, the book is published under your name, and I'm sure you would want it to be reflective of your knowledge and experience. And secondly, uninformed students will read this book, and because of the renown of its author and the fact that it's in its eighth edition, will take its it as fact, its contents. I don't think that's right. Below are three errata, all references up to the sixth edition. On page 201, quote, a decline in the stock market means that the net worth of corporations has fallen because share prices are the valuation of a corporation's net worth. Well, that's not true. That's not true. Market capitalization is you take the number of shares in a corporation and what the market price is, multiply one by the other, and that's the market capitalization. Net worth is something else. Net worth is you take your assets, everything you own, and you subtract your liabilities, what's left over, that's your net worth. Now, accounting 101, they teach you the stuff about a balance sheet, you know? They teach you what net worth is, okay? And market capitalization, in investing 101, they teach you that. So how come you have this erratum? You know? We're talking about a professor and a former member of the Federal Reserve. He couldn't have written this. I mean, the guy's too smart for that. Somebody else wrote it. Oh, but there's more. On page 342, then if the interest rate on this bond rises, say, from 8% to 10%, and I thought to myself, wait a minute. I said, there is a confusion here between rate and yield. Of course, the interest rate on the bond remains the same, but the yield will fluctuate depending upon the price paid for the bond. This is investing 102, you know? But it's still a serious mistake. And so who's writing this stuff? He's not writing it. It maybe had some graduate students write it. Well, I checked the acknowledgments, and there are 63 people who reviewed this manuscript, which is now a book. 63 people. Didn't anybody say anything? Did people just gloss over this? I mean, it's contrary to fact. And for God's sake, this is a textbook, and there's misinformation. Oh, there's one more. But this is personal. Nobody pays any attention to this. On page 240, quote, the attractive feature of adjustable rate mortgages has encouraged mortgage issuing institutions to issue adjustable rate mortgages. The term mortgage is being used very freely here. Institutions don't issue mortgages, rather they issue mortgage loans. In common parlance, one speaks about going to the bank to get a mortgage when, in reality, they are giving a mortgage. However, I believe in the textbook that there needs to be more clarification of the word mortgage, if only a footnote. So, you want to buy a house, $200,000, you don't have that amount of cash, you go to the bank. You go to the bank not to get a mortgage, you go to the bank to give a mortgage. And in return, for having that mortgage on your property as collateral, they will lend you money. So they give the mortgage, you give them the mortgage, and they give you the money. So you've gotten a mortgage loan. Now, rarely when you read financial stuff do you see anybody making any distinction between the two. But as I said, in common parlance, you know, we talk about going to the bank to get a mortgage, okay, but it's not. And when you get a statement from the lender, it'll say having to do with taxes. It'll say taxes are to be paid by the mortgagee. I, who bought the house and borrowed the money, am the mortgagor. But the bank is the mortgagee, and so the taxes are going to be paid by the mortgagee because I send them money. But you know, when you don't know when you use language that loosely, especially in something like finance, where most people know very little about it, it can be dangerous. So I respectfully bring these errata to your attention and hope they will be corrected in future editions. With best wishes, Ed Walpert. And he's thinking, who the hell is this guy? I never heard of him. Well, a lot of people haven't. But that doesn't make me wrong. And I know the reason. I've reconstructed the reason why this happened. 63 people reviewed this. Nobody picked up on it. Okay? The problem is you need special proofreaders. Okay? In order to find mistakes in something like this, you have to know something about it. Have to know, you know, I mean, you have to know what the definitions are. You have to know what net worth is. You have to know what market capitalization is. If you don't know, you're not going to see that they've made a mistake here. So I published a book about 15 years ago called Trading Options, A Conservative Approach to Trading Options. Groundbreaking, really. Made a lot of money with it. And this was proofread by many people. And there were a couple, I proofread it myself very, very carefully, and a lot of my friends did, and my then wife did, you know. And I said, I'm gonna send this to somebody who really knows this stuff. So there's a fellow named Randy Frederick, who is he's the derivatives guy. Options are kind of a derivative. He's the derivatives guy in Schwab, okay? And I sent it to him, and he sent it back, and thanking me. He said he liked it very much. He had several corrections, six of which were just, I had defined something not using the industry standard for that. Okay, well, I didn't know. I wasn't in the industry. But he found one thing, which was I had used a put, the word put instead of call. You know, he says that's substantive. I said, okay, well, thank you very much. So he writes a book a couple years later, Trader's Guide to Equity Spreads. Okay, he writes this book. And in it, in a note to me, he says, oh, I have to tell you, I made a mistake. And he told me where it was. But the point is that in order to read this and be able to spot errors, you have to know something about it. In order to read this, you have to, this is even more esoteric, you have to know something about this. I think at publishing houses, what they do is they have some English major. Okay, and the English major is going to look for misspellings, sentence fragments, punctuation, all the mechanics. But they don't probably, you know anything about this. So how could they possibly find an error? And I think that's what happens. So, when you read something and it's not accurate, respond. Do something, okay? Don't let it sit there. And I should tell you that with regard to this book, I did get a response from Michigan that afternoon. I wrote it on a Sunday morning. That's before I was a member of MLUUC, and I had my Sunday mornings free. I wrote to Michigan on a Sunday morning. Sunday afternoon, I got a response. You know what he said? He said, perhaps your professor did not contact the right person at the publisher. I said, well, that could be, but you know, how about owning up to your mistakes? How about owning up to the idea that something was published that has misleading, inaccurate information, you know? Wouldn't it be nice if somebody said something somewhere? So anyway, these are some things that have happened in my life, and things that piss me off, and what to do, okay? Do we have another slide? I'm not sure we do. Yeah, okay. In conclusion, and everything, whew. Okay. In conclusion, things that piss me off, what to do, what I say as a citizen is, if it's wrong, or if it's offensive, or it's inaccurate, notice it and try to try to fix it. I think that should be a responsibility of each and every one of us. Make the world a better place. Help people know right from wrong. Some people don't, and they should, and you can help them. That concludes my remarks. Open for discussion or comments. Yes, Dane.
Mm-hmm. And whether these can be humorous or not. You said that some of the funniest jokes you've ever heard were ethnic jokes.
Mm-hmm.
But you said something afterwards that made me think. You said that essentially based on the color of one's skin or one's genetic predisposition, that a joke can no longer be funny even if it's the same joke.
No. It can be funny. My point is, who's telling the joke? If it's a member of an ethnicity or a member of a racial group who's telling the joke, and I laugh, we're laughing together. But if I'm telling the joke about his ethnicity, that's not nice. If he laughs, it just has a different meaning. But the jokes are still funny. It's just that I don't have the right to tell jokes about black people. I don't have the right.
Is it Chris Rock or your Uncle George?
What?
Is it Chris Rock or your Uncle George who's telling it?
What is she talking about?
Chris Rock is a famous black comedian who dwells into black culture and black material.
Oh, okay.
He's hilarious.
Okay. Okay. Yes, John. No, wait a minute. You say,
I'll say
it irks me or it pisses me off. You can't say irks me off.
It is, because I'm on Facebook quite a bit, but it's the people that have some sort of post, that share a post that is obviously inaccurate. It's wrong. It has no basis in fact. What I do, and this is getting to my point, what I do is I go to Snopes, and I look up to find out whether it's true or false. And more times out of not, my suspicion is correct and it's false. But what I do is I just copy the web URL out of Snopes and I paste that into my reply and say, this is patently wrong, it's false. I have lost more friends on Facebook but I feel that I'm right because I'm doing what you say, which is I'm identifying a wrong that's being passed on, being
good.
Shared up.
You know, in Scripture, it is written, the truth will make you free. But it doesn't say anything about the truth will make you popular.
Well, the book says how to lead friends influence people, because you don't criticize people. And what I'm doing is criticizing, complaining, and the people are taking it that I'm condemning too, but I'm not.
You're not doing it to make friends. You're doing it to correct something that's wrong. That's good. I compliment you on that. Now you have to be willing. If you're going to do this, you have to be willing to people not talking to you. You know. Yes, Carl.
Misinformation and slanted news and things that are just patently false being touted all over the internet and from one person to another. And if you know for a fact that something is wrong, don't be a bystander.
Good. Good point. Helen, you had a comment?
I think the internet is the worst place to get information. I mean, kids in high school believe everything they read. And they'll come ask me, is it true the Illuminati is running the country? And I don't even know what the Illuminati is. And I say, no, it's not. But it says so. I mean, this taking in of everything that you read as being probably true is just not true anymore. You've got to watch out for it.
Do you remember, I remember when I was a kid, you're talking to somebody and that I read it in a book and that would make it true. Well, I think we're beyond that now. Or I read it on the internet. Yes, Mike. Actually, interesting you asked that, because this has become a pet peeve of mine. I mean, something that really, really pisses me off. I went online and I bought, I think it was the 9th or the 10th edition. By the way, according to Warren Buffett, Michigan is making a fortune out of this. Well, you know, I didn't want to buy the latest edition because it's too expensive, so I went on Amazon and I got, you know, an edition beyond the 8th. And I couldn't find what I was looking for. He completely revamped the entire presentation, and he has all kinds of stuff, websites and exercises and this and that. So I didn't even bother looking, but I certainly hope so, because this is not tough stuff. This is elementary.
Hey, I just wanted to affirm what you said about the use of the N-word through an example. I had a African-American chaplain that I worked with, became very good friends with. He and I served together in the desert. And we were both working on our PhDs together while we were on active duty using tuition assistance. But anyway, and we both finished our PhDs before we retired. But so I call him up one day, and he says, "Oh, Chaplain Sturgis, Dr. Sturgis." He says, "My nigga." And I'm like, I would never use that word. But he told me, he says, "You know that's a term of endearment."
Yeah.
You know, so for an African American to call someone else an N-word, or even a white person, my N, that's cool. For them, it's a term of endearment.
Yeah.
But I would never. I shouldn't.
That's exactly exactly my point. Thank you for bringing that up. Yeah. Anyone else? Comment?
Well, thank you.
I'm done. Yeah.